From NPR News, this is Foreign Dispatch, a weekly roundup of some of the best coverage of news and events filed by NPR's correspondents from around the globe. I'm Kevin Beasley. This week, women drivers in Iraq, Jewish tensions in Jerusalem, an unusual voice for peace in Turkey, and the monarchy facing extinction in Nepal. When Saddam Hussein was still in power in Iraq, the streets were full of women drivers. In fact, to hear Iraqis tell it, they had a higher proportion of women drivers than most other countries in the Middle East. The US invasion changed all that. What with bad traffic, aggressive convoys, and radical insurgents, the streets today are not for the faint-hearted. NPR's Dina Temple-Ruston reports from Baghdad.
Azhar Abbas has been driving children to school for the past 28 years. Her bright yellow van is a fixture in El Andalus district, a prosperous neighborhood of two-story houses on the southeast side of Baghdad. She says she's been doing this so long, she's actually driving some of the children and grandchildren of kids she drove years ago. Parents pay $17 a month for her to ferry their children to and from school. She's so popular, her nickname is Dollar. She says that's because everyone is chasing her to drive their children. The children climb into her bus and take their seats, waving goodbye to their teachers. She laughs and says, "See how calm and well-behaved the children are?" Azhar is a big woman, both tall and round. She has long, wild red hair and is partial to tight-fitting leopard skin tops and oversized costume gold jewelry. She's the kind of woman who lights up a cigarette and offers to read the fortunes revealed from the grounds in coffee cups. In this country, where nearly every woman on the street is either veiled or in a long black abaya, Azhar stands out. The only time she wears a headscarf, she says, is when she buys gas.
All the gas stations here are controlled by the Mehdi army and special guards, so to get gas I have to wear a headscarf.
She holds up a headscarf and laughs.
The other day I went to the petrol station without my headscarf on, and they told me next time I better start wearing it.
When her young sons told her it was just too dangerous for her to keep driving, she told them it was impossible to stop. Driving was in her blood. There is something tender about her interaction with the children. She instructs them to open the door and then get into their houses quickly. To be sure, driving in Baghdad is tough going. The streets are chaos. Traffic circles are a continuous snarl. Electricity isn't reliable. So traffic cops hold up red and green plastic discs at intersections, like human traffic lights. Convoys are a constant worry. American vehicles are topped with gunners on swiveling turrets. The way they spin around when the vehicle takes a corner reminds you of that spinning teacup ride at Disneyland. Except, of course, they have their finger on the trigger of a .50-caliber machine gun. The Iraqi police travel around in trucks. Their big guns are mounted on the truck beds. From long experience, civilian drivers have learned to just pull over as soon as they spot them. With all that to deal with, it isn't surprising many Iraqis have decided getting behind the wheel just isn't worth the risk. Aida Habu is a 50-year-old engineer who has been an avid driver for 25 years. She rarely drives now and has become nostalgic about driving.
I remember when we used to go to Mysore or to other places in the springtime. It was really fun. You could smell blossoming flowers in the breeze. We used to go as a group of women to shop or eat at restaurants. Because of the turmoil today, we only drive in our own neighborhoods.
Amira Hadi Ibrahim, who owns a fashion boutique in Baghdad, agreed.
The streets are not as they used to be, and when I drive, I just don't feel comfortable. I find myself expecting that something bad will happen.
Ibrahim says she bunches her errands together, so she only has to drive on a single day for a limited amount of time. College student Samar Nihad lives in Doura, which is in South Baghdad. The main problem there is insurgents.
They have stopped women in the streets and warned them not to drive again because, as far as they were concerned, it was forbidden by the Quran. They also distributed leaflets that women were not allowed to drive. In fact, they have deprived women of everything. So we're afraid.
Alam al-Wakil, an Iraqi doctor, says she hasn't driven since she was shot by soldiers in an American convoy for driving too close to them. Today, she won't even drive to the market in broad daylight.
Iraq won't be back to life again until I can drive without fear, until I can stop at a red traffic light and can drive away when it turns green. Only then can I say that everything is back to normal.
Until then, al-Wakil and many women like her will wait to get back behind the wheel. Dina Temple-Raston, NPR News, Baghdad.
There are increasing tensions between some Jewish communities in Jerusalem. Some of the more ultra-Orthodox Jews are leaving their cloistered neighborhoods in central Jerusalem for cheaper housing in the suburbs. In some areas, that's caused conflicts and even sporadic violence between the newcomers and their modern Orthodox or secular neighbors. One small group of ultra-Orthodox extremists has been intimidating fellow Jews that they deem not to be kosher or modest enough, or who don't keep the Sabbath the way the ultra-Orthodox want them to. NPR's Eric Westervelt reports.
Sally Walby, an ultra-Orthodox Jew, spends his days studying the Torah. He lives in this sprawling, quiet suburb of Ramat Beit Shemesh, a half hour outside of Jerusalem. In an outdoor shopping area near a local supermarket, the slight 18-year-old says he approves of the big signs posted everywhere by his fellow ultra-Orthodox imploring women to dress modestly. Women wearing jeans or pants, Walby says, are a distraction to what he calls the focused, settled minds of the Haredim.
When dealing with this issue of Torah, your mind has to be much more settled. It can't be jumping around to all sorts of different planets, you know, all sorts of different fantasies and thoughts that might come up on a teenager's head.
Or, he says softly, into the head of a married man. We're not trying to change people, he says, but they must respect our way of life. The problem is, this is a public shopping center in a mixed suburb where Haredim make up a little over a quarter of the population. And a minority of ultra-Orthodox here have tried to impose respect using rocks, fists, and intimidation. Dr. Hava is a modern Orthodox woman who dresses modestly, keeps kosher, and observes the Sabbath. One day, driving home, she saw that someone had put up a sign in her neighborhood that read, "Don't pass here unless you dress modestly."
I find that offensive. I don't think that anybody should impose dress codes on the public.
When she tried to haul the sign down, some ultra-Orthodox pelted her and her car with rocks. Dr. Hava, who asked that her full name not be used, went to the local police, but she says they did nothing.
It's very hard. I know the people who attacked me, and when their families come to see me as a doctor and I can't say anything or do anything because it's unprofessional.
That rock attack was hardly an isolated incident. People driving on the Sabbath here have been bombarded with rocks. Earlier this year in Beit Shemesh, a young Haredi woman was sitting next to an Israeli soldier on a public bus when ultra-Orthodox men assaulted both of them and forced the woman off the bus. Men and women, they said, should be segregated. Later, an ultra-Orthodox man who stood up to the zealots within his own community was himself brutally beaten. Shalom Lerner is the deputy mayor of Beit Shemesh.
One of the problems with this group of violent fanatics, I would call them, is that they don't know how to handle when they have a disagreement.
The deputy mayor says some Haredim have felt estranged as rising costs and overcrowding have forced more and more of them out of their sheltered neighborhood, Mea Shearim, in the heart of Jerusalem and into the suburbs.
Culturally, it's a big change for them. This is the first time these group of peoples are moving out of Jerusalem, out of Mea Shearim. They're not used to seeing a woman in pants. They're not used to seeing a woman with uncovered hair. And they find it very hard to adjust.
Lerner, an observant modern Orthodox, says Beit Shemesh leaders said enough is enough after some businesses received mafia-like threats to put up modesty signs or else. Then a family whose television was allegedly visible through a window got a threatening letter demanding they cover up the TV or face attack. Lerner says the town made it clear to the ultra-Orthodox that there will be big legal, financial, and political costs if the threats, bullying, and violence continue.
If it's a school they want, so the school will be the last one to get the allocation. It won't be where they want. We won't give them any financial help. If they want to be tough, we'll be tough.
This past summer, community members started a group that's trying to narrow the religious and cultural divide through dialogue. Organizers say they've made some progress. But both sides acknowledge the goal of the dialogue in the end is not wider integration, but a kind of peaceful segregation. David is a 25-year-old ultra-Orthodox who studies Torah here full-time.
If they want to be the way they want, we want to be the way we want, we can't put them together because it's two different things. It's two different worlds.
Eric Westervelt, NPR News, Ramat Beit Shemesh.
An angry public debate is underway in Turkey over the conduct of last month's military incursion against Kurdish separatists in northern Iraq. Turkish nationalists accuse the military of prematurely ending the offensive under pressure from the US. But others in Turkey are criticizing the decision to take military action in the first place. Among them is a singer who's better known for her sex change operation than her involvement in politics. From Istanbul, NPR's Ivan Watson reports.
Bülent Ersoy is no stranger to controversy. The artist was banned from performing on stage by Turkey's military dictatorship after she underwent a sex change operation in 1981. Years later, an elected civilian government officially recognized Ersoy as a woman and allowed her to resume her career as a singer of Turkish classical music. More recently, the transsexual diva became fodder for the local tabloids when she married and then divorced a much younger man who was a contestant on the Turkish version of American Idol. Ersoy appears as a judge on that program, and it was on that show last month, at the height of the Turkish army's incursion into northern Iraq, that Ersoy suddenly became the country's most vocal war critic. Seated in front of a giant digital Turkish flag and dressed in a frilly white gown, the raven-haired singer challenged the Turkish army operation.
This is not a normal war. I'm not a mother, but if I could give birth, I wouldn't sacrifice my child for this conflict.
Angry calls flooded the state broadcasting watchdog after the show. The government agency rebuked the TV station, and a prosecutor has since launched an investigation to determine whether Ersoy insulted the military, which is considered a criminal offense in Turkey. Some Turks, however, are quietly applauding.
People got very angry with her, but in essence, she was right. She was spelling out the gossip around the kitchen table of a normal Turkish family.
Mehmet Ali Birand is a veteran TV news anchor. He says Ersoy voiced doubts that many Turks won't dare say in public.
She was saying instead of organizing a military operation, get down to the table and solve the problem politically as well.
Turks are fiercely patriotic. They are also passionate about music. At the CD shops that line Istanbul's busy İstiklal Street, people were divided over the outburst from one of their most beloved singers. She's wrong. You're not a man in Turkey until you do your mandatory military service, says this 24-year-old conscript named Hasan Peker. He says he petitioned to be sent to the front lines during the Iraq incursion. Next door, music store owner Songul Tanrikulu, who is a Kurd, called Ersoy a brave woman.
She shows the sensitivity of a mother saying that, you know, she would not send her child to war. And I think this is really incredible.
Hugh Pope, an expert on Turkey with the International Crisis Group, says the diva's televised outburst is a sign of the democratic progress this country has made in the last 20 years.
She touches a chord with the Turkish people, and that she should take a very emotional political stand is, and that she feels free to express it on a major television station is, I think, a very hopeful sign that Turkey can start grappling with the underlying issues of the Kurdish conflict and not just the military ones.
Turkey withdrew its soldiers from northern Iraq on February 29th. Meanwhile, Ersoy is standing by her remarks. At a press conference, she said she did her artistic duty by confronting a taboo and added that if the state presses charges, she will defend herself in court. Ivan Watson, NPR News, Istanbul.
Coming up, the monarchy facing extinction in Nepal.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new MDX with super-handling all-wheel drive. More information is available at Acura.com.
This is Foreign Dispatch. I'm Kevin Beasley. The world's last Hindu monarchy is on the verge of becoming extinct. The Himalayan kingdom of Nepal is on a path to becoming a republic. The country's interim government has decided to abolish the 240-year-old monarchy, but that decision has first to be confirmed by a new assembly, and elections to that body are due next month. NPR's Philip Reeves reports from Kathmandu.
When King Gyanendra of Nepal gazes out at his kingdom from his pink-tinted palace in Kathmandu, he surely no longer enjoys the view. His grubby, tumble-down capital has changed. Hindu wedding parties still parade through the streets just as they've always done. The ancient pagodas and shrines and seething narrow alleys are still there against a breathtaking backdrop of the Himalayas. But his subjects are different. They no longer revere him, the king, as a living god, the incarnation of the Hindu deity Vishnu. In fact, these days, the atheist hammer and sickle, emblazoned on the bright red flags of his Maoist enemies, is visible just beyond his palace walls. The Maoists want to throw him out and abolish the monarchy. It's not hard to find Nepalese who agree with them.
King should finish, you know. Every people don't need monarchy.
The king should go, says J.B. Rowell, an auto parts dealer. We all hate him. Spurned by the public, King Gyanendra has become a brooding, isolated figure. His portrait, adorned with a crown of peacock feathers, has been removed from Nepal's banknotes. And now he's in dispute with the government after refusing to pay the equivalent of more than $800,000 for overdue electricity bills. Electricity's a sensitive subject among Nepal's 29 million people, residents of one of the world's poorest countries. It's a rainy night in the city's Temel district, a warren of bars, boutiques and massage parlours. The shopkeepers, wrapped in woolly hats and padded jackets against the cold, hawk their wares by candlelight. Much of the country has no electricity supply, and even here in the capital, there are power outages every day, lasting 6 or 7 hours. And people have trouble using generators because of a severe gas shortage. The final chapter of King Gyanendra's downfall began 3 years ago. That was when he seized absolute power, promising to end the insurgency by Maoists, who by then controlled much of the countryside. 14 months later, this happened. The public took to the streets, for day after day, for what were sometimes violent protests demanding democracy. The king eventually capitulated and handed over the reins of government to a coalition of political parties. The Maoists agreed to stop fighting and joined an interim government still in place. But the decline of Nepal's monarchy began before that. It began in 2001, when the crown prince went on a drunken rampage and shot dead the monarch at the time, Gyanendra's brother, Birendra, along with much of the rest of the royal family, including himself. Journalist Kunda Dixit says this changed Nepal forever.
I think the massacre was a seminal event in completely demolishing the respect and the honour and the worship that ordinary people had for the monarchy.
After the massacre, Gyanendra, a businessman with a reputation for ruthlessness, took the throne. Dixit said he made a useless monarch.
I wouldn't surprise me one bit that he hasn't paid not just his electricity but his water and other bills as well. And that's why he's so not liked. You know, I mean, he hasn't shown statesmanship, magnanimity, and the generosity of spirit that you need to be a modern-day monarch.
Nepal's Maoists have been pressing hard for the abolition of the monarchy, threatening to return to war if they don't get their way. Hisila Yami is one of their leaders. After years underground, she's now a government minister.
We want to make it over. He has been looting the whole country, you know.
If you ask ordinary people, the man on the street, they still love the institution of monarchy from the bottom of their heart.
King Gyanendra still has a few friends. That's Kamal Thapa, one of his former ministers who now heads a political party. Thapa's running for a seat in the new assembly, due to be elected next month to write a new constitution. He hopes the assembly will decide to keep the king. Nepal has scores of competing ethnic groups. Separatists have been causing havoc in the south. The country's still recovering from the wounds of the brutal civil war with the Maoists, which saw terrible atrocities by both sides and cost thousands of lives. The king's supporters say the monarchy is essential for holding the nation together. As for the king's unpaid electricity bills, Kamal Thapa has this explanation.
Basically, this is a planned hate campaign against the institution of monarchy and king in particular.
The aim of that campaign, says Thapa, is to ensure that the lights go out in the palace of Nepal's king forever. Philip Reeves, NPR News, New Delhi.
For more international coverage, you can listen to your local NPR station. You'll find a list at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, you can find more international stories by clicking on News and World. For NPR News, I'm Kevin Beasley.